Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Building Community Food Webs by Ken Meter. Narrated by Patrick Lawler. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to visual elements present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Introduction. It is difficult to imagine how meager food choices were 50 years ago. At that time, I could find no organic food items at the supermarket. Today, organic food sales have soared to $45 billion per year. White bread was mainstream. It was nearly impossible to buy whole grains for home cooking. Today, I can purchase bulk grains in any quantity I desire, grown by a farm I have visited. Back then, grass-fed beef was an exotic import. I didn't yet know that some of the beautifully marbled cuts of beef I ate would later cause my heart distress, and it was decades until I learned that cattle were not meant to eat grain. The only farmers I knew were my cousins in Nebraska, who were suspicious of my suburban upbringing. My family trekked 8 hours to visit them each Labor Day, in part because my father wanted me to know what a ripe watermelon tasted like. He also sought to show me what an austere farm upbringing he had had, and how far my cousins had progressed. Now I can find sweet melons at my co-op grocery. A farm family I cherish delivered meats, cheese, and vegetables to my front door during the coronavirus pandemic. These new food choices were sparked by the vibrant community foods movement that emerged across the U.S. around 1969. That movement has set a deep taproot in diverse locales across the U.S. While its promise seems straightforward, that all people should have good food, adherents hold a wide range of motivations. Some join to cure themselves of a disease. Others seek to protect themselves from illness by eating the purest foods possible. A few hardy souls want to dig in the dirt so they can feed their neighbors while caring for the earth and connect to consumers who will support their quest. Cultural enclaves renew their ancestral heritage of growing food for all. Entrepreneurs launch businesses in a quest to make money, while thousands of food security leaders dedicate themselves to ensuring that those lacking wealth, low income, and other marginalized people have the best food available. Some organize their neighbors to take action, knowing that a democracy cannot survive unless it feeds itself. Most promising to me, food leaders collaborate across all shades of the political spectrum, convinced that food cannot be a partisan concern. All of these viewpoints and more drive the work of community food webs, overlapping networks of grassroots leaders who are determined to define their own food choices. I use this term in kinship with two community food groups, the Ten Rivers Food Web and the North Coast Food Web in Oregon, which incorporate the term into the names of their organizations following the inspiration of the visionary farmer Harry McCormick. While it is meant to express an awareness of our interdependence with and care for the environment, the term carries a different meaning here than it does in the scientific work of ecologists. Often this movement is referred to as the local foods movement, but I have found its strength runs far deeper than that. I will say more about this in Chapter 11. Local food efforts are often limited to the privileged or hollowed into meaningless marketing campaigns. This movement is more inclusive. It gains its most lasting victories when it builds community. Indeed, its competitive advantage is that it builds strong relationships of trust among those who engage. Most critically, it builds mutual loyalty between farmers and consumers, because farmers face special risks no one else faces, including severe weather events, climate change, fickle markets, and bodily harm. They need consumers and policymakers who will help mitigate these risks. The movement is fueled by a conviction that we need to forge the food systems we deserve, rather than merely accept the food systems we inherit. Despite the extraordinary pressures stacked against its success and the intense resistance it faces, the community foods movement persists. Its dogged spirit is one of the most compelling reasons I have for writing this book. Exceptional victories have been won by taking slow steps over decades, but these achievements seldom reach the daily news cycle, nor do the movement's leaders gain national prominence. Rather, the work of building community food webs plays out on remote farm fields, inside the coolers of a local grocery store, and at spare conference tables in municipal halls. This book is based on work I have shouldered over the past two decades on the invitation of local foods leaders in more than 140 regions across North America. I've partnered with food webs in 41 states and two provinces and with four Native American tribes. It has been a rare privilege to be invited in and the richest educational experience of my life. This book will bring to light some of the best food webs I know of, showing the steps each took to become more effective. Many of these stories are simply not available anywhere else. One central paradox drives people to construct community food webs. This paradox both creates the need for community food webs and frustrates our efforts to build them. Although our highly productive commodity farming has extensive global reach and a small number of farms have become quite large and efficient, the prevailing food system systematically extracts wealth from rural and urban communities alike. This book traces a loss of $4 trillion of potential wealth from rural areas over the past 100 years. That is nearly one quarter of the current annual gross domestic product for the U.S. It also amounts to more than the current value of all U.S. farms combined, $3 trillion. The massive subsidies given to farmers help input suppliers and lenders a great deal, but play a strong role in drawing wealth from the rural economy. Losses such as these have fed deep divisions in the countryside over recent decades, which exploded politically in 2016. U.S. farmers largely raise commodities for industrial processing, while even farm communities import most of the foods they eat. It is typical for 85% to 95% of the food people consume in any state to be grown outside of the state boundaries, while 95% of the commodities farmers raise are shipped to distant buyers. Urban communities lose wealth as well, spending billions of dollars each year purchasing food sourced on distant farms or processing plants. Food systems have also eroded in recent years. This extraction means that over the past seven decades, I have also witnessed the erosions of the food systems I depend on. I will discuss some of these in the next chapter, but let me begin in a more personal manner. My mother, Margaret, an RN, prepared such great meals and kept such a cogent household that I went for six straight years without missing a day of school to illness. She taught me subtle cooking touches, such as how to add ingredients in the proper order to enhance the flavors of each. Our home meals were so well crafted that eating out held little interest for me. Even today, it is rare for a restaurant chef to outdo my mother's daily fare. One of Margaret's unfulfilled quests was to recreate the immense round loaves of dark rye bread her grandmother Anna had crafted in a wood stove, as Anna had learned in her home country. I have this recipe in the wooden box of handwritten recipes I inherited. Margaret never felt she had the bread just right. Even after hours of consultation and mutual baking efforts with her sisters and friends. As I continue that quest, I find that my efforts improve when I turn to heritage grains and natural leavening. But even these efforts are probably not as nutritious or as flavorful as they would have been during Anna's time, because nutritional quality has been sacrificed for commercial appeal. My father, Clarence, who was born in a log home on a farm in Nebraska, inherited his grandfather's farming genes. He became a respected science teacher and then a labor lawyer, but he always missed the land. During World War II, at the end of his workday, he took over two vacant lots near the duplex apartment they rented so he could grow a victory garden. He grew enough so that he could give fresh vegetables to several neighbors. My parents loved to tell the story of how they scrubbed their bathtub with cleanser one year, using the vessel to ferment a hearty crop of cabbage. The apartment stunk for 2 weeks, and my parents imposed on the neighbors upstairs when they needed a shower. They paid them in sauerkraut. The canned stuff, Clarence added, was never as good. When I was young, he nurtured tomato plants on the south side of our house until they stood 8 feet tall and strained under the weight of bright red globes. I live in that same house today, and I tend the same compost pile, though I have shifted the garden to the front yard as the tree canopy expanded. I try to carry forward food traditions that are harder and harder to maintain as our lives become uprooted. As just one example, I cook oxtail soup each year at Christmas time, as Margaret did. None of my childhood friends had any idea what oxtails were, but for me the soup conveyed a rich story as well as winter nourishment. During the Depression, a few years after Margaret's father died suddenly from an unrecognized heart defect when she was 16, her uncle, Louis Kreutz, owned a meatpacking house in the same town. On Saturdays, he would bring oxtails to give to her family, 10 children with a single mother, at the end of his workday. It was one of his ways of easing their burden. Margaret's carefully crafted holiday ritual served as a warning to her sons on multiple levels. People sacrificed so you could be here today. Be ready, because hard times may come again. Clarence underscored this message with his own stories. His first wife and an infant son had both died in childbirth, and he had lost all of his savings when his rural bank closed in the span of 1 week in 1931. No packaged foods could convey such heritage. Does the United States truly feed the world? In our public discourse, it is difficult for us to comprehend the extractive nature of the food system because we carry an image in our minds that the U.S. feeds the world. The reality is far more nuanced. Our country has constructed some of the most productive agriculture and some of the grandest supermarkets on the planet. Technological advances have fashioned attractive packaging that extends shelf life to a remarkable extent. American consumers spend $1.7 trillion each year purchasing food, an amount roughly equivalent to the value of the Apple Corporation. Yet the U.S. food system endures a tortuous crisis. In this country that feeds the world, SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, food stamps, have escalated from $7 billion in 1969, in 2017 dollars, to $60 billion in 2017. In many farm communities where I work, more net income is earned through food stamp benefits than by farming, and even farm families find they need SNAP. In some areas of the heartland, farmers spend more purchasing farm chemicals to grow commodities for export than would be required to feed all of the residents of their county for a year. One of every 8 Americans, 40 million people, is food insecure, meaning that at some point during the year, they are not sure where their next meal is coming from. At the same time, people who eat too little are getting fat because their diet is out of balance. 2 of every 3 Americans are either overweight, 35%, or obese, 31%. Diet and exercise-related illnesses such as diabetes have become epidemic. Americans now spend $327 billion each year paying the medical costs of diabetes. This amounts to 90% of the $359 billion farmers earned by selling crops and livestock in 2018. In a very real way, for each dollar we spend buying commodities from a farmer, we give a second dollar to our healthcare system to treat us for the consequences of the food we eat and our lack of physical activity. In 2017, long before the deeper disruption caused by the coronavirus pandemic, net farm income was lower than at the onset of the Great Depression. U.S. farmers earned a net cash income of only $4 billion in 2017, far less than the $56 billion in 2017 dollars the sector earned a century ago, even though farmers more than doubled productivity. The number of farms declined from 6.4 million to 2 million, so there are far fewer rural families holding a sense of ownership in their communities. Meanwhile, farming has become the most dangerous occupation in the country. This is all a consequence of constructing a food system in the U.S. that subsidizes commodities but holds that communities should fend for themselves. Farmers raise tons of cash crops and livestock that are industrially processed or exported, but sell only a fraction of what they produce, $2.8 million or 0.7%, directly to U.S. households. Meanwhile, consumers search further and further for the foods we eat. More than half of the fresh fruit eaten in the United States was imported in 2016, up from 23% in 1975. Fresh vegetable imports rose from 5.8% to 31.1% over the same period. Speaking socially, youth have become an export crop of farm communities, nurtured carefully just like field corn, and then shipped to urban centers. The intense competitive pressures placed upon farmers producing for global markets sets farm family against farm family and limits many aspiring commodity farmers' notions of success to what is the biggest equipment I can buy, or worse, how can I purchase my neighbor's farm? Consumers are similarly atomized. The average American knows less about where their food comes from or how it was produced than their ancestors a century ago. Schools have steadily dismantled programs in agricultural education and home economics. Few Americans hold even a rudimentary understanding of food safety, and thousands do not even have pots or pans in their kitchens. But almost all shoppers recognize corporate food logos. What should a food system accomplish? Those who launch community food webs are challenging the prevailing food system at a fundamental level, asking for better outcomes. What then should a food system accomplish? For many food investors or businesses, the principal purpose is to reward shareholders with dividends. Such a confining definition of success inevitably distorts our understanding of the food system by giving us a shallow view. It overlooks important concerns that do not fit into that limited purpose. Thinking only of monetary margins and returns, farmers and business managers often focus solely on cutting costs or increasing sales. While important, the outcomes discussed earlier make it clear that this is insufficient. Overlooked in this notion of success are the environmental costs associated with raising food as cheaply as possible. These may be invisible today, but they will haunt our grandchildren in the future. Overlooked are the cultural celebrations that help place farmers and consumers in a productive, rooted context and keep spirits strong. Overlooked is the central importance food plays in cultivating health and the distribution of wealth that results from the food choices consumers make. Overlooked is the need to direct the healthiest food we can produce to those who can least afford it for the sake of public health. My own definition of the purpose of any food system is that it should build four key strengths in each community where it operates: health, wealth, connection, and capacity. Implicit in each of these is the imperative of creating equity. Health. Foremost, an effective food system should build health among its constituents. Eating the most nutritious food possible is, after all, the number one strategy any of us has for staying healthy. This is the way we bring essential vitamins, minerals, micronutrients, protein, and carbohydrates into our bodies. This is how we feed the microbiota we depend upon to stay healthy. If our food is tainted with disease-bearing microbes or chemical residue, or if it lacks nutritional value, we are likely to suffer complications later on in our lives. On the producer side, raising food should also involve physical labor that makes us stronger. A successful food system cannot be built on the backs of farmers or farm workers who contract cancer from exposure to chemicals, or who must shoulder repetitive, boring tasks that deplete the soul. The work has to hold meaning and help connect us to others. It must also be spiritually and financially rewarding. That brings me to the second purpose, wealth. Wealth. It is also immediately apparent that a food system must build wealth in communities. This is particularly true for farm communities. If farm families do not build wealth by farming and do not trade with those who live nearby, the food system will be unstable. A food system centered on a few wealthy individuals or corporations that own almost all the land, trade largely outside of their communities, and hold disproportionate political power is a type of feudalism, not a democracy. On the surface, it may appear that consumers benefit from low prices paid to farmers at the farm gate, and that this advances their own prosperity. Yet purchasing food items grown by distant farmers sends money away from the communities where consumers live, and it limits local farmers' income in ways that are overlooked by national data sets. Grocery stores can only exercise independent judgment if the stores are locally owned and responsive to farmer and consumer needs. In general, the greater the consolidation of power and finance, the fewer options communities hold. After all, the primary reason a supermarket chain enters a given community is the promise of drawing profits from consumer purchases. Ultimately, when this happens, wealth is built by outsiders at the expense of local choice. To counter this, consumers can help build their community's wealth by purchasing food at a fair price from farmers they know. Connection. Less visible in our civic discourse is the need for a food system to connect people more closely to each other. This is one of the reasons serving culturally resonant foods is so important. People come together at such meals to strive for a sense of belonging, to celebrate their heritage of working the land, and to honor ancestors who carved out successful lives amid great adversity. Ample research has shown that those communities holding the most equitable social connectivity are those most able to respond to crisis, and food is an exceptionally potent connector. Sadly, most policy discussions completely overlook our need to connect around food. Capacity. Finally, an effective food system builds the capacity of its community members to make smart choices and take effective action on their own behalf. Those who engage with an effective food system will know how food is grown, and this understanding is central to people's making healthy food choices as consumers. Such knowledge will help them prepare safe, healthful, and savory foods. Knowing how food is grown also enables consumers to make informed decisions as they shop and eat. Unfortunately, an industrialized society such as our own suppresses our personal skills in handling food safely because of the multitude of prepackaged items we enjoy. Many people are so distant from farms that they cannot recognize common raw vegetables. Few understand what is involved in growing food. Consumers often rely on a frozen food container or canned food label to tell them how to prepare a product, never learning to construct a nutritious meal for themselves. As a people, we have come to accept and even expect simple answers. The ease of selecting from a menu has often become preferable to the complexity of learning from the fits and starts we experience as we make things with our own hands. Building a culture of collaboration. As I have already discussed, the prevailing U.S. food system fails on all four of these counts. We are compelled to create alternatives. Although none of the emergent community-based food webs covered in this book have achieved global success, each has progressed on all four fronts. Each cluster of food leaders takes deliberate steps forward until larger opportunities open up. Each identifies at least one key lever to shift, creating larger impacts in their community food system. Each has, in its own way, built a local culture that fosters greater collaboration by connecting personally to build trust, by heightening a sense of mutual respect, and by keeping a focus on where they are trying to move over the long term. It is these cultural webs that unify the diverse campaigns to build health, wealth, connection, and capacity. Many of these groups that are represented here are telling their stories for the first time. Each spells out the pragmatic steps they took, but each of those steps was taken in a unique context at one particular time. I trust listeners will sift through these stories looking for clues about how to adapt the strategies portrayed here in their own communities. No single book can capture all of the stories that could be told about this vibrant movement. Indeed, it was difficult to limit myself to the stories presented here. Many others could be told. From 2003 to 2010, I attended annual meetings of the Community Food Security Coalition, where as many as 1,000 food animators convened to share insights. Each of them would have similar stories to convey. The ones I include here are the ones I can tell the best, because I am the most closely connected to them, and because people volunteered their time to share their experiences and refine my account. That said, it is also true that my colleague, Megan Phillips Goldenberg, and I have been invited to assist some of the most far-sighted community food initiatives, so these rank among the most inspiring stories I know. Moreover, this book focuses on food initiatives that have flourished since the mid-1980s, but the latest iteration of this movement began about 1969-70 and claims roots that go back to Reconstruction and beyond. Among the first visionaries guiding the current wave were members of the Federation of Southern Cooperatives, who mobilized tens of thousands of blacks against terrifying opposition to build wealth in their community. FSC members pooled their savings so blacks could purchase farmland, built solid savings accounts, and formed cooperative food businesses. FSC invited me to their offices and fields for interviews in 1986, but their own members can tell a more complete story. In northern metro areas, the food movement expressed itself through young farmers who relocated to rural areas to grow food for people to eat. They collaborated with urbanites who formed cooperative grocery stores. Urban gardening and greenhouse efforts emerged in ethnic neighborhoods of cities such as Chicago, Detroit, Los Angeles, and New York. A preview of this book. This book has three basic parts. First, I present a financial accounting of the ways that the prevailing commodity system has extracted wealth from rural communities. In the second part, I highlight several of the most impactful efforts to build community food webs that I have had the privilege to partner with. Finally, I will summarize several critical themes that guide this work, again drawing on specific field examples. Chapter 1 includes a series of charts that will show how cynical policymakers took advantage of the 1973 OPEC energy crisis to transform a farm economy that was somewhat balanced into one that inherently extracts wealth from rural America and urban America as well, although this is more difficult to document. This occurred just after a community foods movement began to emerge. Further, the chapter identifies four periods over the past century when U.S. farmers reached brief moments of prosperity and explains why that occurred. It will show how volatile farm income has become and how consistently net income eroded, even in a commodity industry that is highly favored in policy circles and heavily subsidized. This is critically important to understand because the primary justification for the prevailing food
sample complete. Ready to continue?